The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Can you help me, please? I've had a problem with my health for years and I can't get to the bottom of it. The doctors have run out of ideas.
I'd love to help. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session.
Right, can you book me in, please?
For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
If only I'd found out about you sooner, it would have made so much difference.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. My name is Kirsten Hartwig, and this is the Herbal Medicine Show, brought to you by Heartwood Herbal Education. Welcome to your weekly dose of plant power. This week's theme is Mind Matters. Our guest in the garden is Canadian herbalist Jean-Charles Cabrera, who will initiate us into the world of biophilia, a therapy form that emphasizes the love of life. Jean-Charles also tells us about slow forest walking as prescribed by doctors in Japan. And I'll be talking to Dr. Michael Evans, who is a British GP, anthroposophical doctor, and Goethean scientist, and faculty member of the Medical Section Seminar on Mental Health. Dr. Evans will be telling us about natural approaches to mental health and depression. We have news from the garden and would like to introduce you to rosemary, an essential herb when it comes to lifting spirits and warming the heart. We also have news of research showing that turmeric improves memory and can help prevent neurodegenerative disease. And some of you will be pleased to know that, according to a recent study, eating breakfast late is good for weight loss. The problem is that you have to have early dinner too, and nothing in between. Another interesting diet study is good news for plant lovers because it proved once again that eating a Mediterranean-style plant-based diet can help protect you from depression. We start with news that eating your greens can help you avoid depression, according to research published in Molecular Psychiatry. Eating a plant-powered diet based on fruit and vegetables, nuts, seeds, grains, and olive oil may offer some protection against depression, especially if you also avoid meat and dairy products and other pro-inflammatory foods like sugar and shellfish. Depression is the psychiatric disorder placing the heaviest burden on society in developed countries, and the aim of the study was to see if there's a link between diet and depression, making more tools available to cope with this debilitating condition. The conclusion was that following a Mediterranean-style plant-based diet can offer some protection against depression, especially when combined with fresh air and exercise, while cutting down on mood-altering products like sugar, caffeine, and alcohol, according to Stephen Buckley from the mental health charity Mind. Next up is a study on turmeric from UCLA, the University of California, published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, which concludes that the curcumin in turmeric improves memory and prevents neurodegenerative disease in later years. A double-blind study examined the effects of turmeric in improving mood and attention span in people over 50. The study ran for 18 months, and the results indicated that participants who took turmeric had significantly improved their cognitive function compared to those who received the placebo. Especially recall, visual memory, and attention span had improved. Exactly how turmeric affects the brain is not certain, but it may be due to its ability to reduce brain inflammation, according to Dr. Gary Small from UCLA's Longevity Center. And, according to the Journal of Nutritional Science, a late breakfast followed by an early dinner makes a good recipe for weight loss. According to research from the University of Surrey, introducing A daily mini fast makes you eat less because you're less hungry. There are no restrictions on what or how much you can eat. Only your window of opportunity for eating is reduced. Participants were put into two groups for the experiment, one with altered mealtimes and one keeping normal mealtimes. Results showed that those who had later breakfast and earlier dinner ate less, felt less hungry, and also naturally cut back on snacks between meals. You're listening to UK Health Radio. My name is Kirsten Hartwig, and this is the Herbal Medicine Show. This week we have an interview with Dr. Michael Evans, who is an expert on mental health and author of the book Healing for Body, Soul and Spirit, an Introduction to Anthroposophic Medicine, published by Flourish Books. I asked Michael what anthroposophical medicine actually is.
Well, it's a holistic approach to medicine, really, that takes into account the ordinary physical findings of ordinary science, but adds a sense for the life forces and the soul properties, the inner life, the emotional life, and the spiritual life of patients, and sees health, or tries to see health, in terms of all four levels of the human being's existence.
Beautiful. And did you train as a medical doctor first and then...
Yes, I trained in the UK in conventional medicine. And then after spending a foundation year at Emerson College, I went to Germany and worked in anthroposophic hospitals, both for patients with physical illnesses and then in the clinic specializing in psychiatric illnesses. And then came back to help start a anthroposophic therapeutic community in the Midlands called Park Atwood, which ran for about 30 years.
How interesting. So did you train medical doctors to become anthroposophical doctors, or did they start from scratch?
Well, I'm involved in doing that now. Uh-huh. I run a three-year training, part-time training, for doctors wanting to explore anthroposophic medicine, about 20 days a year. And one of the training methods that I'm interested in is really giving people methods to explore plants and nature and the organs of the body and issues like depression, really out of their own experience and their own observations, rather than teaching them textbook facts, but instead giving them methods of discovery for themselves. Goethe's science differs from ordinary science in that it takes seriously the qualities that people can sense, their own observations, their own sight, what they can see, what they can also have as real imaginations as how a plant grows in time, and also the inner feelings that a particular plant conjures up, just like meeting people conjures up different feelings in us. And it encourages the participants to take those seriously. Whereas in ordinary science, any subjective experience is really bypassed or avoided for fear that it will lead us astray. And so we have in ordinary science something that almost misses out the human being. And Goethean science it attempts to really replace, put the human being back in the process. And so this plant study method begins by observing in great detail the plants, and almost like an anatomist would study the body. But the next stage is to try to work out how the plant grows in time, and to create almost a moving picture of the growth in the mind's eye. That's the kind of the time process, you could say, of a plant, rather than just what you can see at any one moment.
And what can you learn from that?
Well, that seems to help the observer really connect to the inner process of growth of a plant. And that allows a third stage where people are asked, well, if you've just met if this was a person, what kind of personality do you feel it has? What kind of mood do you think it conjures up in you? And to share that.
Mm.
So people share this kind of more, in inverted commas, personality quality of the plant, which for some people sounds a bit strange. And then the next stage is to kind of almost distill that into what is really you feel unique about this particular plant. What are the sort of inner qualities of this plant? And the next stage is to say, well, let's take this as a hypothesis. Let's take it seriously and ask ourselves who might be helped by a plant with those inner qualities. And then the participants imagine the illnesses that it might help, and we collect them. And on the next day, overnight, we check in the textbooks what's in the herbal textbooks, what's in the homeopathic textbooks, what's in the textbooks of Ayurveda, what's in the anthroposophic textbooks. And what's remarkable is that it seems that at least 60 or 70% of what people come up with is confirmed by the textbooks.
Isn't that wonderful? And
so it's a feeling that this method allows people to really get a sense for the use of the plants themselves, rather than being totally dependent on literature, dependent on reading and what other experts say.
And that must also have been the way, it must be connecting to the way people learned about what plants to use before we had chemistry labs and clinical trials.
Yeah, that's right. But what I find also quite moving is that not only might it reconnect ourselves with what people in ancient times have come to, but it can also relate to what more conventional medicine has to say. So the last session we had, we looked at a plant called henbane, which is also used in conventional medicine a little bit. And what we discovered was that the uses we came to were also confirmed by ordinary scientific medicine.
Wow.
So it seems to be a method that not only connects ourselves with tradition, if I can put it that way, but, conventional science as well.
That's fascinating.
But it makes it feel much more human, if I can put it that way, or humanly incorporating the observer as a participant.
And didn't Einstein say that the observed depends on the observed, that in everything changes as soon as you start observing something, you participate with it? I can't remember the exact quote.
More open-minded scientists sort of can acknowledge that,
And have you had experiences with using anthroposophic medicine for depression, and have you had good results with that?
Yes. Particularly what's quite well known, I think, is St. John's wort or hypericum, which is a mild antidepressant. And for milder forms of depression, this might be all a person would need.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that the plant studies that we made also helped us come to a picture that it could be used for depression. And the interesting thing is conventional tests have also shown it to be effective. But again, without doctors being open-minded to try to use something like this, it kind of gets forgotten about. But we found it really quite useful. Also, homeopathic medicines such as Aurum or Gold, I think, can help depression. And anthroposophic medicines, one called Onopordon Comp, can help, particularly if there's a combination of depression and anxiety.
So the last one you You mentioned, is that a homeopathic
No, it's really a Sufic remedy. You could say it's a specific herbal mixture of three plants prepared from an anthroposophic point of view, very much to help the heart, but not the heart seen as a pump, but really the heart as the centre of a person's sense of being, really. And when you're anxious or depressed, you often feel you've kind of lost your centre, and it can help recover that sense of oneself, sense of one's centre.
And with Hypericum, how did you find that work? Like you said, the anthroposophic medicine works on the heart. Could you say you had found out where or how Hypericum works?
I mean, in a conventional point of view, I think they're finding that Hypericum works in a very similar way to ordinary antidepressants, but in a gentler way. So from that conventional view, a more kind of pictorial understanding is that the Hypericum, which is called St. John's wort, which means it grows at St. John's tide, which is midsummer, has a very special relationship to the sun. And when we studied it, we had the feeling that it is really a kind of representative of the sun and of gold. And the sun is really the whole, as everyone knows, the basis of all life.
And it gives the us heart life of the matter.
Exactly, and it gives us warmth. And I think particularly when you're depressed, you know, the fire has kind of gone out of you. And it can, I think, relight that fire. That's my more pictorial image of what Hypericum can do.
I think that's really interesting you say that, because Hypericum, if you take it in a herbal preparation or as a Hypericum oil on the skin, it makes you more photosensitive or more sensitive to sunlight, and you have to be careful not to.
Right.
I mean, when I was a student, one of my friends treated his girlfriend's backache with Hypericum oil, and then she went out and sunbathed, and she had this discoloration on her back, I think, for years afterwards.
The other little research study that was made was that many people in the very northern countries, Scandinavia, are known to get quite depressed in winter when there's a lot of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the treatments for this seasonal affective disorder, as it's called, is sun lamps, so light that has almost the wavelength of the sun, sort of phototherapy, known to be effective. And they found that actually you could use Hypericum instead. So it's almost as though Hypericum and is the equivalent of sunlight.
Oh, wow.
So I think that's also a kind of just an interesting way of understanding Hypericum.
This week we're talking about self-help for depression and anxiety states. Psychotic depression is a severe emotional disturbance, more common in middle age. The sufferer may become agitated or profoundly withdrawn and lethargic, and may experience hallucinations and delusions. There are disturbances in bowel habit, appetite and sleep, and the real risk of suicide. While reactive depression is a reaction to traumatic events such as bereavement, and may be accompanied by anxiety and disturbed appetite and sleep. The underlying causes are not completely understood, but contributing factors include physical disorder, such as underactive thyroid, and also diet, food allergy, smoking, drugs, and lifestyle. Measures to prevent or manage depression include taking regular exercise and avoiding smoking, alcohol, and caffeine, using alternatives to oral contraception, eliminating food allergens and additives, particularly aspartame, which is found in sugar-free foods and drinks. It often helps to eat regular meals with plenty of fresh fruit and vegetables to stabilize blood sugar levels and to optimize your nutritional state. Eat foods high in vitamin B and C and magnesium and tryptophan. And as Dr. Evans said, St. John's wort is an effective herbal antidepressant, and herbs that support the adrenals, such as borage and licorice root, are also valuable. Good foods for depression include avocado, banana, beans, endive, green leaves, mango, muesli, peas, red pepper, rice, soy products, tahini, and yeast extract. Anxiety states are dominated by fast pulse, sweating, butterflies in the stomach, lightheadedness, and a feeling of apprehension and fear. Chronic anxiety takes a toll on the immune system and can lead to physical illness such as irritable bowel syndrome. The cause can be hormonal or linked to overactive thyroid and premenstrual syndrome or a traumatic event. It can also be a symptom of psychiatric illness such as depression or dementia. Once hormonal imbalance has been ruled out, anxiety can often be managed with foods that strengthen the immune system, such as oats, potato, sweet potato, butternut squash, okra, red pepper, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, artichokes, spring greens, curly kale, apricot, grapefruit, walnuts, beans, and yeast extract again. Herbs to calm the nerves include chamomile, lemon balm, rosemary, lavender, and passion flower.
When everything is shaking, at the point of breaking comes the fun. After the bearing and the stripping, the tearing and the splitting comes return. After the fire of revolution, innovation and solution comes the start. After the watching and the waiting, the patient contemplating comes advance. After the thunder and the rain, the drama and the pain comes release. After the parting of the ways, at the ending of the maze comes peace. After the coming of the dark that puts out every spark comes the dawn. After withdrawal and retreat, to avoid defeat, comes the strong. After the poison and the trauma, the illness and disorder comes progression. After being undermined and the danger of decline comes resolution. After exhaustion in the wasteland, where there's nothing you understand, you find the well. When you're standing on the peak and you've got all that you seek, comes the still. And when you're standing on the peak and you've got all that you seek, comes the still.
This week the garden has been full of sunshine and autumn colours, the paths becoming golden with fallen leaves. The hydrangea is changing colour, and this is a good time to pick a bunch, remove the leaves and dry it upside down. When it's dry, you can put it in a vase or a potpourri and make the colours last all winter. The nights are cooler and longer, but the days so warm that many herbs have a second season. I've seen dandelions in bloom and white hoarhound, marigold, herb robert and shepherd's purse too. And the birds are still singing. My guest in the garden is Jean-Charles Corbera. Jean-Charles runs Innisfree Farm and Botanic Garden on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, where she lives, grows herbs and practices herbal medicine when she isn't traveling around the world giving workshops. This week to the Heartwood Herbal students at Emerson College in Sussex, where my garden is. Apart from being an inspired speaker, medical herbalist and clinical aromatherapist, Jean-Charles is also a certified master gardener and horticultural therapist. Today in the garden, I have the great pleasure of welcoming my friend and colleague and old fellow student from the School of Herbal Medicine many moons ago, Jean-Charles Corbera, who is now living in Canada on Vancouver Island, where she has a botanic garden. And in fact, I have a lot to thank Jean-Charles for, because she was the inspiration for starting the botanical garden at Emerson College. So with great pleasure, welcome Jean-Charles.
Thank you, Kirsten.
And today I was hoping you would tell us about what you have been teaching here at Emerson College this weekend, because you've been teaching herbal students about herbs, but in a very particular way.
Yes, what we've been doing this weekend is herbal medicine, but it's much beyond that. It doesn't only apply to herbalists. It's something that everybody could partake of, and indeed does partake of, whether they realize it or not. Our theme for the weekend was a topic called biophilia,
which biophilia
means the love of life.
Yeah.
So the term was coined in 1974 by Erich Fromm, maybe 1973 actually, by Erich Fromm, who was a German-born American living psychoanalyst. And he spoke of the innate relationship or resonance that people have with the natural world. In 1984, the term was picked up by a professor at Harvard called E.O. Wilson, and he wrote a book called The Biophilia Hypothesis, in which he hypothesized and suggested that there is an innate resonance of the human spirit to the natural world, particularly the plant world, and that it actually has a genetic basis, that we are, if you like, hardwired to have a positive response in the natural elements, in the natural world. And I find that very exciting, because the concept of this genetic correspondence of people to the natural world around them has now actually been validated since the breaking of the genome. We're able to look deeper and deeper into the construction of DNA. So DNA holds the genetic code. It's sort of like the library that the body can go and read when it needs to learn something new or make something new. But DNA, as again, most people will know, does have a twist. So it's sort of like a ladder that's twisted around into what's called a double helix.
But how is that? I understand that. And but what I keep wondering now is, how does that translate into love?
Well, love is a human concept for a feeling or an emotional experience. We call it love, but it's actually an experience. And although you're not perhaps going to fall in love with an oak tree, well, actually, maybe herbalists could and would.
I mean, I have fallen in love with a tree before.
But it is a different kind of love. It's not the love you have for your sweetheart, your children, your pets, your parents. It's a different kind of emotional response that we have to nature. And it does have a genetic basis. So back to the DNA, when the DNA twists and spirals, when that ladder twists into the double helix, It's not evenly twisted. Not every turn is the same tightness as the next turn. There are tight turns and loose turns. There's a sort of open texture and then a closed texture and then an open and a closed. And there is a very, very fixed mathematical ratio between those turns, between the wide turns and the narrow turns, or the open turns and the tight turns. It's fixed on a mathematical ratio.
Is that what they talk about, the golden ratio?
It's called the golden ratio, and the ratio specifically is 1.6. That is the larger turn of your DNA is 1.6 times the length of the shorter turn.
And so that's what you see in spirals, like
in shells. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the patterning of the pineapple or the seeds in the sunflower or the arrangement of the pine cone. So what I'm really saying here is that the patterns you see in nature as spirals are not only genetically determined, which I think everybody would understand, the genes of that living creature have created those spirals, but that spiral, that mathematical proportionality of the spiral, is actually reflecting the same mathematical pattern in the DNA. So there is a spatial correlation.
Wow, isn't that beautiful?
Your DNA is actually the same mathematical proportions as the spirals of a shell, of a snail shell, or even if you want to go bigger into the proportions of the hurricane, the eye of the storm, or even the elliptical orbits of the planets are spiraling at the same proportion as your DNA.
Wow, that is brilliant. But Jean-Charles, how does it translate into love? Because love is at one moment, isn't it?
Or that's about connectivity. About feeling connected. But I ask this question of many people. I ask people to imagine themselves being upset and stressed and distressed, maybe angry, maybe frightened, and really feel that in their body, feel their belly tightening and their breath getting short, and then imagine themselves in a place, a location that creates peace and harmony and relaxation.
So you don't have to go there physically.
No, you don't.
Go there inside.
But what happens when you ask people, where did you go? Mm-hmm. Now, most people will say that they went somewhere in nature. Somewhere that there was a big tree or a body of water or some flowers. And then the question is why? Why there? What is that draws you? And my belief is that because we have this physiological resonance with the natural world, we are literally at the DNA level, we are created from the same material in the same patterns, that when our patterns have been thrown off kilter by the busy day and the busy brain that we live with, we go back to nature to regroup. What makes that happen inside of you that generates that response? That's biophilia. Mm. It is a resonance with the natural world, which is genetically coded because our DNA is patterned on the same mathematical formula. What the exercise is called is a practice from Japan called Shinrin-yoku. And that translates as forest bathing therapy.
Forest bathing therapy.
In Japan and Korea, this is a medical discipline. You can get a prescription from your doctor to go walk in the forests.
Wow.
If you have stress or post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety.
That is so sensible. The Japanese are so sensible, aren't they?
Yeah, but Japan was a very interesting country. Like many people, I think, my vision of Japan was very urbanized, high-tech, digital, neon,
nuclear.
And that's true. It is like that, but only in the cities. And the cities are built around the fringes of the island and in the low-level valleys. 73% of the countryside of Japan is uncut forests.
Wow.
73%
wow.
has never been logged.
Gosh, I didn't know that.
So in Japan, in the 1980s, it was recognized that there was therapeutic medicinal value for people going to the forest and walking in the woods. So they created this Shinrin-yoku forest bathing therapy practice. And it's really, if you like, a practice of mindfulness. It's a mindfulness meditation practice, a contemplative walking, and consequently very slow. It's very hard, actually, to walk slowly. And it allows you to be very, very attentive and aware of everything around you and practicing being right here, right now, in this very moment.
Like Eckhart Tolle says, be here now.
Be here now. Yeah. So in Japan, you can now, for example, there are 65 designated forest bathing sites around the country. And some of them, for example, have little huts when you get to the beginning. And you can measure your blood pressure and you can do a finger prick test of cortisol, which is a quick read of stress.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do your prescribed walk and then you measure your blood pressure and cortisol coming out. And Japan being Japan and very techie, all of that's instantly uploaded to your doctor's office.
Wow.
And he can not only see that you've met your prescription requirements, but he can measure the improvements day by day, each day that you go to the woods.
So there's plenty of scientific evidence.
There is so much scientific evidence. Now, and that was some of what we looked at this weekend. We were looking at some of the research studies and the papers and how they did them and what they found.
And what did they find?
They found that it works. Big surprise. People feel less stressed, more management of their issues and their control, more control over their challenging emotions when they've had a walk in the woods. And we know this instinctively, like we started out talking about, if you're stressed and distressed, you go out to nature to find some solace. So we do this instinctively. Japan has simply made it into a therapeutic discipline.
That's wonderful. We should do that here.
Mm-hmm. So back to the biophilia, really, that's just a fancy term for our happy place when we're in nature, for something that most people do instinctively without even knowing it. And Shinrin-yoku is, again, a term for something that we do naturally and instinctively, but now it's been, if you like, formalized into something that has an insurance code on it so your doctor can prescribe
it. And also, I think that you can do something, when you do something consciously, you perhaps get more out of it. That's brilliant, Chantal. Thank you very much.
Without the wild, the world will be tame. Nothing unexpected, everything just the same. Without the wild, the wind would die, or the sea would be calm as a pool. Nothing to stir us, no storms fast and furious, just the flat, safe world of fools. Without the wild, we'd lose a child and conform. Conform, conform. In neat little lines, without our own minds, we'd be oh so safe and so warm. But such safety comes with too high a price, selling your deep sea soul so everything can be so nice. Such safety comes with hollow eyes, where tomorrow's dreams are drowned in lies. Without the wild, the bees would die. Oh, and honey would be a thing of the past. Watch the lightning crack up the sky. Watch the thunderbolts smash and blast. Bow your head before the volcano's power. Bow your head before the beauty of each wildflower. Lift your head and breathe the wild wind by the sea. It's the untamed that unchains and sets you free. It's the untamed that unchains and sets you free.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. My name is Kirsten Hartwig, and this is the Herbal Medicine Show. A very useful and easily available herb for anxiety and depression, memory, circulation and digestion is rosemary, Rosmarinus officinalis, a member of the mint family. Rosemary stimulates circulation and supports the nervous system, and it's also an effective treatment for tension headache. It is a traditional tonic for the heart and has a calming effect on digestion. Rosemary is a lovely, highly aromatic evergreen shrub and has always been greatly valued for its use in both medicine and cooking. To the ancient Greeks, rosemary had a reputation for strengthening the brain and memory, and it became an emblem of remembrance, love and friendship. Rosemary has a pungent, resinous taste and a delightful scent. It contains tannins, bitters and a strong volatile oil similar to eucalyptus. Take one or two fresh sprigs or one teaspoonful of the dried herb to a cup of boiling water. Infuse 5 to 10 minutes and drink 2 cups per day. You can make rosemary oil by putting fresh tops and leaves in a jar with good vegetable oil and allow it to soak for a week on a sunny windowsill and then be filtered and kept in an airtight bottle.
It was here.
Goethean science, as mentioned earlier by Michael Evans, arises from the natural philosophy developed by the German writer, philosopher, and statesman Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who was born in 1749 and died in 1832, aged 82. Goethe was a literary celebrity by the age of 25. His first major scientific work, The Metamorphosis of Plants, was published in 1788. And although his literary work attracted the greatest amount of interest, Goethe was also a keen student of natural science. His focus on morphology and his ideas of transformation were about the continuous metamorphosis of living things. In Stories of My Botanical Studies, he wrote, "The ever-changing display of plant forms, which I have followed for so many years, awakens increasingly within me the notion. The plant forms which surround us were not all created at some given point in time and then locked into the given form they have been given. A felicitous mobility and plasticity allowed them to grow and adapt themselves to many different conditions in many different places." We've come to the end of this week's Herbal Medicine Show on UK Health Radio. Thank you for listening, and thank you to Michael Evans and Jean-Charles Cabrera for sharing their knowledge and insights, to Essie Jane, Peter Firebrace and Nick Rowley for the music, and to Steve and Nick from Heartwood Production Team for superb technical support, and to Heartwood Herbal Education for making it all possible. Next week, I'll be talking to naturopathic practitioner Aaliyah Spring about her holistic approach to cancer, and I'll also be reporting from the recent Plant Consciousness Conference in London and telling you the latest news from the herb garden and the world of plant-based medicine. Please join me again next week for another dose of plant power.